Now, I'm going to present a lot of evidence about this today before we get into the Christian principles in the Constitution, of which I will contend there were many, many. As the first bit of evidence, I want to read to you the program of the Liberal League. It's the program of the Liberal League. Should sound familiar to you. I'd like you to consider each of these demands that are made by the members of the Liberal League. Consider them in light of what has happened, what is going on today in our government, civil government, law, and public life. First, we demand that churches and other ecclesiastical property shall no longer be exempted from just taxation. Taxation of churches. Second, we demand that the employment of chaplains in Congress, in state legislatures, in the Navy and militia, and in prisons, asylums, and all other institutions supported by public money shall be discontinued. Third, we demand that all public appropriations for sectarian, educational, and charitable institutions shall cease. Fourth, we demand that all religious services now sustained by the government shall be abolished, and especially that the use of the Bible in the public schools, whether ostensibly as a textbook or avowedly as a book of religious worship, shall be prohibited. Fifth, we demand that the appointment by the President of the United States or by the governors of the various states of all religious festivals and fasts shall wholly cease. We demand that the judicial oath in the courts and in all other departments of the government shall be abolished, and that simple affirmation under the penalties of perjury shall be established in its stead. Seventh, we demand that all laws, directly or indirectly enforcing the observance of Sunday as the Sabbath, shall be repealed. Eighth, we demand that all laws looking to the enforcement of Christian morality shall be abrogated, and that all laws shall be conformed to the requirements of natural morality, equal rights, that's the familiar phrase, and impartial liberty. Ninth, we demand that not only the constitutions of the United States and of the several states, but also in the practical administration of the same, no privilege or advantage shall be conceded to Christianity or any other special religion. That our entire political system shall be founded and administered on a purely secular basis. And that whatever changes shall prove necessary to this end shall be consistently, unflinchingly, and promptly made. Now, this demand, or this set of demands from the Liberal League, is not something that was cooked up as a program for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. It is not something demanded necessarily by last year's Democratic Party convention. This demand, or this list of demands, first arose in the United States in the 1870s. We have been at war for a long time. You can see how thoroughly humanistic this is. You can see that these people knew very, very well what they were doing. Now, this list of demands I'm almost positive led into the American Civil Liberties Union and various other kinds of things. But it doesn't take too much reflection to see that they have achieved in large measure what they set out to do, and that they're working on achieving the rest. Now, the question must immediately arise, if they could set forth this list of demands, this list of programs, back in the 1870s, for our government to cease all these practices, what sort of practices have been going on? There must obviously have been very, very many connections between Christianity and civil government in this country. Otherwise, why would they make such militant demands that they cease? There were many, many connections between Christianity and civil government. And it is to these that I want to turn. I want to get us into the historic context. Because when we see all these connections between Christianity and civil government, then either the Christians took over a secularist government and made it Christian. This is a little bit of a line you do get in some of the various textbooks that talk about the great revivals of 1800 and so forth, the Second Great Awakening. The idea being that the Constitution was founded during a period of decline of Christianity, a low point for Christianity. It was founded basically on secular basis, and then the Christians in the wake of this great revival somehow took over civil government. I'm going to argue that that is patently false. When you get back and look at what actually went on between Christianity and civil government, there was no divorce of Christianity from civil government. Not before the Constitution was framed, not during the period that it was being framed and ratified, and certainly not for many, many years thereafter. Okay. Now, we should note, first of all, the colonial heritage. I just want to remark on that very, very briefly. Obviously, this land was settled mainly by Christians, not by secularists. I don't intend to go into each of the histories of the colonies, but they were settled as Christian colonies. You look at the laws and the charters of these colonies, they were obviously Christian laws and charters, right from the Mayflower Compact on down to the end of the colonial period, or rather, right from the Charter of the Virginia Colony, which was founded, after all, before the Plymouth Colony was, right on down to the end of the colonial period. All right, I want to focus, though, especially on this period of Constitution framing after independence. I want to talk a little bit about the war for independence, but before I do that, I want to look at the religion of the American people during the period of independence and the Constitution and thereafter. I want to look at education, and I want to look at law. Then I want to look at the acts of civil government and the connections between that and Christianity. First of all, the religion of the people was definitely overwhelmingly Christian. This is not to say that everyone was a Christian. Far from it. But the whole religious tone of society in America, or of the various societies which made up these United States, and which made up the British colonies in North America, was definitely Christian. And on top of that, Protestant. And on top of that, clearly Calvinistic. Whether we're talking about the Congregationalists up in the New England area, or the Presbyterians, who really were spread throughout the length of the colonies, or the Baptists, who were increasing in numbers and were spread throughout the length of the colonies, or even the Anglicans. Basically, these people had a Calvinistic background. The Anglicans had a Calvinistic confession in their 39 articles. The various groups of people who came over here to settle were out of a Calvinistic background, whether we're talking about the Scotch-Irish or the English Puritans and Pilgrims, or even the Germanic people, let's say the German immigrants and so forth, the Swedish, the Swiss, the Dutch, were basically all Calvinistic in their theological background. This didn't prove that everybody was a Calvinist, not by a long shot, but this theology, with its acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God over all areas of life, with its acknowledgement of the fallen, sinful nature of man, pervaded the thinking of the people, and certainly pervaded their public and civil government in ways that we will see in more detail later on. Now, to be sure, the Great Awakening of the 1740s to 1770s did attenuate that Calvinism a little bit. It did change it in the direction of evangelical Christianity. There's no doubt about that. You had more of an emphasis on the revival, shall we say. and on emotional conversion experiences and that sort of thing. Nevertheless, if American's dominant theological position remained Calvinistic at the time of the War for Independence. To be sure, you did have some intrusions of deism. No doubt about that, especially in New England. But deism was not anywhere dominant. As a matter of fact, even in New England, as Alan Heimert has pointed out in one of his books, even in New England, Calvinism was dominant because of the Great Awakening, because of its revival of biblical Christianity. So that the theological liberals of that day, the would-be Unitarians, or those who would, let's say in 30 or 40 years become Unitarian, those people were overwhelmed by people they called the Calvinists. So religiously speaking, it's safe to say that, as Sidney Ahlstrom has said in his really standard scholarly work on religious history of the American people, that fully 85 to 90% of the American people at the time of the Revolution, the so-called Revolution, better known as the War for Independence, more accurately known as the War for Independence, 85 to 90% of the American people were out of a Calvinistic background and were influenced by Calvinism, whether or not they were church members and whether or not they were really and truly Christians. All right, so there was some theological rationalism, some deism, and so forth. But we need to remember this. Even though it is true that Christianity was at a low point during the War for Independence and shortly thereafter, still, America's civil government, America's religious life, and so forth, was dominated by Christianity. We'll see that in much more detail when we get to looking at the state constitution, which we will look at in some detail. There's plenty of evidence of Christianity in those state constitutions that were framed during the so-called revolutionary period. Okay, from the, let's say, 1776 on to 1783 or so. Plenty of evidence of that. All right, so even though Christianity was at a low point, Christianity was still dominant. Now, you need to remember also, to counteract another point that our contemporary secularists like to make, namely that because the early Americans talked about natural rights or natural law or the law of nature, or as the Declaration of Independence puts it, the laws of nature and of nature's God. The secularists tell us that even though, or that because the framers of the Constitution or the framers of these declarations of independence or the men who initiated the War for Independence, led it, and so forth, talked about natural rights and natural law, these men supposedly were followers of modern, would-be autonomous humanistic thought, essentially humanistic thought, man-centered, man-based thought. And not Christian. We could take a lot more time to go into this, but basically we need to remember that although we're told that the men who led the War for Independence, the men who framed the Constitution, were followers of John Locke, shall we say, actually, John Locke got his theories of natural rights, God-given natural rights and so forth, from the Puritans, who had been teaching that there is a law of nature, that there is a law of God that is revealed to man both in the Scriptures, this is what they usually leave out, and that is available to man through reasoning upon the basis of his conscience. So that man can rationally, to some degree or another, know that he has certain rights. And that these rights exist not only over against other individuals, but also over against other individuals who happen to be in positions of civil authority. That is to say, over against civil government. Because you have Because you have certain God-given rights, civil governments may not steal from you. They may not murder you. They may not oppress you. Because you have certain God-given rights, you have certain liberties over against civil government. Now, John Locke was an Arminian Christian who got his political philosophy at Oxford University. Also got it from his father, who was a Puritan captain, and his uncle, who was a Puritan colonel. Long before John Locke was teaching these doctrines of natural law and natural rights and limitations on civil government based on God-given rights, long before he was teaching that you could know these through your reason, the Puritans were teaching the same thing. The Puritans were teaching that both in Old England and in New England. You can go back to the 1630s and 40s. Locke did his writing basically in the late 1680s. The period in which he did his writing. But you can look back at Puritan writings in the 1630s, 40s, 50s, and so forth, right on up through the War for Independence, and get the same teaching. But you must keep in mind that the teaching very clearly was that you can see these same rights most clearly by reading the scriptures. So it doesn't follow then that just because these people talked about reason or natural rights or natural law, that they meant that you only knew these things on the basis of a reason that is divorced from God and His Word. They were Christians and they still believed in this. They still taught this. All right. So we need to know then that this talk of natural law was very definitely intended by these people to be Christian, to be compatible with Christianity. I'll go into this a little more fully and you'll understand a little bit better why that's so when we talk about law in early America, and legal philosophy, and legal education in early America. Secondly, I want to look at education. Now, education is certainly, like religion, like law, one of the keys to understanding any society. You want to understand a society? Look at its education. Why? Because any educational system has got to teach the children what is most important, what the people running that educational system consider to be most important. It has to teach them a view about God and men and things, whether God exists or not, what He's like if He does exist, and so forth. Obviously, a Christian educational system is going to teach you a Christian biblical view of God. It'll teach you a biblical view of man. It'll teach you a biblical view of society and of law and so forth. Today, with our humanistic system, it's easy for us to understand the contrast between a Christian system of thought and a Christian system of education and a non-Christian or anti-Christian system of education. Okay? What we want to do is look at, therefore, the American educational system and see what it was like. Because there we're going to see the sort of religious ideas that were taught, the sort of ethical ideas that are taught. Any educational system has to teach you some set of principles of ethics, morality, right and wrong, good and evil. Even if you deny, with our modern humanists, that there are any fixed principles, any universal principles of right and wrong, good and evil, you still have to teach a moral system, even if it's an immoral system, moral in quotes system. And I suppose the best way to illustrate that is by citing the example of the Puritans. Okay? The Puritans certainly have a bad press because they tried to enforce the laws of God. They weren't the only ones who did. The early Virginia colonists did too. Lots of others did too. Pennsylvania, they tried to do this. And throughout the states, they in general tried to enforce the laws of God. If you today advocate, let's say, opposition to abortion or opposition to pornography shops on our corners and that sort of thing, you would get accused of being puritanical. Terrible thing to be, supposedly. Someone who wants to enforce the laws of God. you're accused of this by people who basically, whose basic moral ethic is that you ought to do whatever you can get away with, or whatever feels good, or whatever is necessary to gratify your desires. They have a moral framework which excludes, as its very given premise, man's duty to obey God's laws. So they have their own moral framework that they try to enforce and inculcate through the educational system. All right. One other consideration we ought to think about in thinking about the educational system. Abraham Lincoln said that the philosophy of the schools in one generation is the philosophy of the government in the next. Okay. We can see that all around us today. I don't suppose I need to illustrate that any further. In looking at the Constitution, since we are told that it was basically a secular document, basically, if you like, a humanistic document, one of the things we need to look at is not only the religion of the people, which we've seen already was dominantly Christian, overwhelmingly Christian, but also the educational system. What sort of education did we have back in those days? Was it pagan or was it Christian? Well, it was overwhelmingly Christian. Whether you were educated at home, as many, many people were, including many of our great statesmen, whether you were educated in one of the so-called common schools in New England, elementary schools and that sort of thing, whether you were educated in one of the old field schools in the South, whether you're educated in a Christian school, a denominational Christian school, or a non-denominational Christian school, or, for that matter, most private schools, or whether you're educated by a tutor, and at any level of education you want to consider, the education was overwhelmingly Christian, was intended to be Christian, and was, in fact, dominantly Christian. Now, this is not to say that it was purely Christian. You did have elements of ancient thought working in there, Greek and Roman thought in particular. You did have to read Tacitus and a lot of these Roman historians, which, of course, if you read through biblical spectacles, is all right to do. In fact, there's a lot that can be learned from history as a moral study by learning what ancient men have done. Certainly, you can see that in the Constitutional Convention. All right, now, even when you get to college education, it was overwhelmingly Christian. It was sort of a Protestant form of scholasticism. Roman Catholic thinkers have studied the type of education that our leaders had, and basically the people who went to college in colonial times, late colonial and early American times, were the leaders of society. That education was basically medieval, except that the theology that went into it was not Roman Catholic, but rather Protestant and dominantly Calvinistic. The same subjects that basically had been studied for 700 or 800 years during the medieval period were studied in early America. And by the way, that education was conducted in Latin, too. In the early years, you had to know Greek and Hebrew in order to get into college. Not many of us could have made it to college. Not many college professors could have made it to college by those standards. Might be a lot better off in some ways if that were the case. But the standards were much higher. Needless to say, this system was much more productive. Classes were conducted in Latin. You were not allowed to speak English in class. You had to speak Latin. Moreover, the content of the education was heavily ethical, heavily moral. They were concerned about how morality, right and wrong, applied to ethics, to society, to politics. And as part of your course, if you went to the typical college, when you got to be a junior or a senior, or the equivalent of a junior or senior, you had classes with the college president, usually, which were ethics classes, in which you learned to apply these ethical principles, which were basically Christian principles, even though they were derived from natural law, I believe, to a large extent. You had to learn to apply these principles to society, to concrete situations in society. And you had to learn to defend yourself in public debate. These, of course, our colleges, you know, were mostly founded to train people for the ministry. But not only for that purpose, they were also founded, especially later on, they modified their curricula somewhat, to train people to be statesmen, to be public leaders. This is what really we should still be doing. Not to say that we would denigrate any of the other callings in society, but we as Christians especially ought to be trained to be public leaders. It's our duty to have dominion over the earth, to glorify our Lord and Savior, to teach nations to do all things whatsoever He has commanded. And in order to be able to do that, you have to be able to think on your feet. You have to be able to apply biblical principles to concrete areas of life. These men were, by and large, taught to do this. Now, again, there was some syncretism there. Even the great John Witherspoon at Princeton, very staunch Calvinist and so forth, very, very involved politically, the educator of several presidents and a number of Supreme Court judges and senators and congressmen and governors, and you name it, did smuggle in Scottish common sense philosophy. I'll talk about that more later on, but Scottish common sense philosophy basically took biblical principles as given and said, well, you know these just through your common sense, forgetting that man's heart is deceitful and desperately wicked above all things, forgetting that man is fallen in his nature and so forth, and is in ethical rebellion against God. Nevertheless, these people were taught that you can know by common sense these Christian principles, these essentially Christian principles which people had taken for granted because they were in a society so dominated by Christianity. All right, so higher education then certainly was dominated by Christianity. And as I said, when you got to be a senior and you were ready to graduate, then you had to put all this into practice, because you had it as one of your assignments to give a defense of a certain set of propositions that were posted publicly. Everybody was invited to come hear your defense of these propositions. And as a matter of fact, other students were assigned to attack the positions that you advocated. And you were fair game for anyone in the audience. So you really had to know your stuff. You had to be sharp. This would not, sort of education would not hurt us. But my main point is that education before, during, and for a number of years after the Constitution was framed and ratified was overwhelmingly Christian. The colleges in the early states did not cease this practice until, let's say, the 1815, 1820, and thereabouts, depending on the college that you're talking about. So for a good while after the Constitution, our education was dominated by Christianity. And of course, even then, the colleges continued to be dominantly Christian. And I'll remind you that public education, as we know it today, or more or less as in principle as we know it today, didn't really come in until the late 1830s in Massachusetts. So it was even longer before public education, which was founded in Massachusetts by Horace Mann and James D. Carter, Unitarians, with the express purpose, well, not express, but with their secret purpose of getting the land rid of Christianity and of solving all of our problems of crime, problems of poverty, and you name it. You can see how successful it's been. It wasn't until the late 1830s that public education, as we know it today, really came into being. Before that time, it was dominantly Christian, no doubt about it, and Protestant and Calvinistic. We could go into this in much more detail. Much more detail. But it is a very, very interesting story and very, very revealing. Now, legal education also was dominantly Christian. There is no doubt about that. And the philosophy of law that we had predominating in this country was basically Christian. You ought to get hold sometime of the writings of William Blackstone. Oh, From 1665 to 1669, William Blackstone published his four volume Commentaries on the Laws of England. I'm just going to limit my discussion to Blackstone because he was the most important force in American legal education from this time right on up through, I almost said the War of Southern Independence, but through what is usually mistakenly known as the Civil War. Every lawyer who was educated in America, whether he did as virtually all of them did, and studied law by reading law with an outstanding lawyer in his community, working in the law offices there, reading Blackstone and so forth, or whether he went to one of the very few law schools that you had available. Every lawyer read Blackstone, digested Blackstone. Blackstone and also Coke, for Edward Coke, another Christian lawyer. Now, William Blackstone taught what was definitely a Christian and Protestant philosophy of law. You look in volume 1 of Blackstone, chapter 2, where he has his philosophy of law set forth, and you see a very clearly Christian philosophy of law. I could read you some quotations from it, but I won't. Basically, it was a natural law philosophy. He said there is a law of nature. This is a law that originally God had given to Adam in the Garden of Eden. It is the law that is essentially the same thing as biblical law. Adam, before he fell, before he rebelled against that law, sinfully seeking to be his own lawgiver, his own lawmaker, walked in his fellowship with God according to the law of nature. He had a perfect knowledge of the law of nature. He knew what he should do and what he should not do. Now, says Blackstone, man, since the fall, has his reason fallen and his understanding darkened. Since man's sin, since Adam's first sin, all of us, as his heirs and descendants, have reasons that are flawed. None of us has perfect reason. None of our understandings are pure and clear. All of our understandings are darkened by the fall. In other words, man's whole being has been radically affected by original sin. This is good biblical doctrine, so that we cannot truly, purely know the law of nature anymore. Men still, however, have a knowledge, have a sort of a hazy view of this law of nature. They know that God requires them to act in certain ways and not to act in certain other ways. So they cook up various theories of natural law. But these theories of natural law are the product of man's fallen reason and understanding. So none of them is perfect. Therefore, said Blackstone, what we have to do is to look to the Scriptures. We have to look to biblical law as our standard. That is the clearest standard we have for the law. And as a matter of fact, said Blackstone, we have this scriptural law and the law of nature basically given to us in English common law. Now, keep in mind, it wasn't just lawyers or would-be lawyers who read Blackstone. Blackstone's book was addressed to gentlemen. Gentlewomen could also read it, and did. It was something you as a gentleman had to know, both to function better in society and to be a gentleman. To be a gentleman, you had to have a wide knowledge of things. This is why when you look to the Declaration of Independence, for example, and see the laws of nature and of nature's God, you can understand, especially when Jefferson tells us that he was simply writing the plain common sense of the matter in the Declaration, that it wasn't a humanistic, man-centered concept, that this was seen by the men who framed the Declaration as being consistent with Christianity. So legal education was overwhelmingly Christian. You can even read books by Perry Miller, for example, The Life of the Mind in America. Perry Miller was an atheist historian, but he was a pretty honest historian. We can thank the Lord for that. He was used, I think, to point out to, well, A, to reinterest us in the Puritans, to make us see that they were people worthy of study, and he has pointed out very clearly that time and again, throughout the first half of the 19th century, before the late unpleasantness, the Civil War, if you will, there were challenges to the common law, but overwhelmingly, thousands of times, America's greatest judges, America's greatest lawyers, and the overwhelming percentage and number of American lawyers reaffirmed that the common law was basically Christian law, and that the common law was basic to the laws of our states and to the Constitution. So they reaffirmed that our law was fundamentally Christian law. You can see this in the writings of Justice Joseph Story, for example, or of James Coke, Chancellor James Coke. Wait a second, let's see. Is that the right name? Kent, that's what I'm thinking, okay. Both of whom wrote books called Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. Story was a Unitarian, but he was an honest one. He said, our laws are basically Christian. So the point that I'm making is that well before the framing of the Constitution, all during the so-called Revolutionary Period, during the period in which the Constitution was framed, and for decades and decades after the Constitution was framed, our laws were overwhelmingly Christian laws. The philosophy of law was Christian, and the content of the laws was Christian. We could spend more time going into that. If you look at the nature of the things that were prohibited, our laws did not smile upon adultery, or easy divorce, or homosexuality, or theft. There are so many, many things that we can see in our laws that get us to see very, very clearly that they were Christian. You had Sabbatarian laws, laws prohibiting the violation of the Sabbath. You had anti-blasphemy laws, and people were successfully prosecuted in the United States a number of times during the Civil War under these laws. You had laws against swearing, as well as laws against idleness, drunkenness, and that sort of thing. If you get back and look at the laws, you see all sorts of evidence of the dominance of Christianity in these laws. All right, you look at wills and things like that. You had, by the way, also biblical punishments very often for these laws. Look at people's wills that were framed during this time. A will was a legal document. The will would begin with the testimony of the person's faith, if he was a Christian. And then you'd get to the division of property and that sort of thing. All sorts of evidences of the dominance of Christianity. So my question is then, just as with education, if education was so dominantly Christian for many years after the Constitution was framed as well as before, if law was so overwhelmingly Christian for many years after, I'm not saying it was perfectly biblical and would agree with every jot and tittle of Scripture, but it was overwhelmingly Christian. If this was the case, how could the Constitution have gone against all of that? What influences on the minds of the framers led them to supposedly create a secularist document? My argument would be none. Let me just mention a little footnote here about people like Jefferson and Franklin. because certainly not all the men who framed the Constitution were Christians. Jefferson certainly, even though he was a member of his local Episcopal vestry and attended church regularly and took part in the services and all that sort of thing, we know in his private life was essentially what would later become known as a Unitarian. Franklin, who like Jefferson gave to the establishment of all sorts of churches, Franklin who made that famous plea for prayer, like a great plea for prayer in the Constitutional Convention, which I understand you've already heard. Franklin who praised the work of George Whitefield. Franklin who knew very well the social consequences of Christianity and therefore urged people not to be promoting anti-Christian doctrines, not because Franklin wanted to glorify Jesus Christ, but rather because as an astute man he knew the disastrous consequences of people following un-Christian belief. Franklin, as a matter of fact, once urged some rationalist, I forget who it was, I think it may have been Tom Paine, that he should be thankful that our people believed Christianity and that we weren't like the Hottentots for whom a sign of manhood was beating up your mother. When you got old enough to prove that you were a man, one of the ways you did that was by beating up your mother. So I suppose that still goes on here among all of us non-Hottentots, or at least many non-Hottentots. But Franklin knew something about the social consequences of Christianity. Therefore, Franklin did not want to undermine Christianity, but rather worked to shore it up. Franklin, although an unbeliever, in his private life, publicly lent support to Christianity. Jefferson, although he did draw up that Jefferson Bible, that infamous document in which he excised all references to Christ's divinity and to miracles and so forth, did that in his private life, not in his public life. Jefferson in his public life praised Christianity. Let me just, and as a matter of fact, never really said anything against Christianity. Let me just cite to you from Jefferson's second inaugural address as President of the United States. Jefferson referred to God and referred to the fact that the nation is in the hands of God. And he said that this God led our fathers as Israel of old from their native land and planted them in a country flowing with all the necessaries and comforts of life, who has covered our infancy with his providence and our riper years with his wisdom and power. And to his goodness I ask you to join in supplications with me that he will so enlighten the minds of your servants, guide their counsel, and prosper their measures, that whatsoever they shall do shall result in your good and shall secure to you the peace, friendship, and approbation of all nations. Okay. This is the public Jefferson, making a very obviously Christian, even Calvinistic, speech to the people of America. One of the things that the humanists like to do, one of the things that they love to do, is to focus on Jefferson when he was out of public office, when he was older, later on in life, and take the statements that he made then, which really had no consequences on his political future, and use them as the standards by which we are supposedly to judge his public conduct and therefore are supposedly to divorce Christianity from civil government. This is one of the things that the people in the Liberal League, whose manifesto I have cited to you at the outset, sought to do. They sought to say, look, these guys intended to establish a separation between Christianity and civil government. Therefore, we must follow out their wishes and do so. They don't tell you about the real public Jefferson, okay? Who, by the way, we're told wanted to be remembered for his plan for the University of Virginia. The humanists like to turn this into a secularist sort of document, because Jefferson did not want the University of Virginia to be dominated by any one denomination, any one Christian denomination. Said, nope, we're not going to have a Christian denomination ruling the thing. What he did want is to have Christian seminaries established all around the university so that the seminaries could avail themselves of the library resources and so forth of the university, as well as make their services available to the students going to the college. Nor do these people tell us, as John Whitehead has pointed out in his book, The Separation Illusion, that Jefferson, when he was, in effect, the public school superintendent, the first public school superintendent for Washington, D.C., and therefore in a position of public authority, public accountability, used for the textbooks of these public school children the Bible and Watts's hymnal, Isaac Watts's great hymnal. So we need to keep men like Jefferson and Franklin in mind, especially when we are given false views of them. Yeah.
Jefferson was a teacher?
He wasn't a teacher. He was the superintendent of public schools for Washington, D.C., the D.C. area. Again, this is not to say that he was a Christian. However, he was a politician, and he knew where the votes were. Yes, Tom.
Concerning the University of Virginia, at first he started without any Christian influence,
yes.
And students went amok.
Yes, sir.
quickly Christian influence.
Yes, sir. I believe Dabney points this out in one of his writings. Yes, indeed. They saw what the consequences are of having a secular university. Yes, sir. Lots of practical experience about that. We can talk about that in regard to public education, too, but I better save that for later. All right, now let's look at the War for Independence just briefly. To begin with, we ought to notice that the War for Independence was fought basically on the basis of a long train of Christian thought, which said that basically you, as a Christian people, had a right to resist tyrants. You can trace this way back into the medieval period, but you can certainly see this very visible in the writings of John Calvin, John Knox, the French Huguenots, the various other Scottish Reformed writers, the Puritans, and so forth. And America, being settled by people who were dominantly Calvinistic, had a very strong dose of this Christian resistance theory, which I could take a lot more time and go into, but won't. Basically, they said that the king is under law. He is under the law of God. And we, the people, have that standard of the law of God. In particular, the lesser magistrates, the lesser civil magistrates, people in positions of civil authority, in civil government, in other words, also have that law of God as a standard over them. And we, the people, can look to this standard. So can our civil magistrates. In fact, they must look to this standard. And if the king, or in the case of the British colonies, the king in Parliament, which mainly meant Parliament, violates the law of God, then we have it as a right and duty to resist that, not to go along with his ungodly commandments. And if he continues to violate the law of God in such a systematic way that he becomes a tyrant, a man ruling without God, a man ruling in opposition to God's laws, then we have a right, especially when we are led by our lesser magistrates, those state, or actually in this case, the colonial officials and so forth, we have a right to even exercise, after we've gone through a long process of petitioning for redress of grievances, just as the colonists did, we have a right to take up arms in order to resist his imposition of tyranny on us. Yes.
So Jefferson adopting the theory that rebellion and tyrant is obedience to God is a general philosophy among all.
Yes, Jefferson was quoting, I don't believe it was Coke, but a much earlier English legal official whose name I've forgotten and whose position I've forgotten. And when Jefferson said rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God, he was just quoting what virtually everyone believed. Certainly they were taught that in New England for years and years and years before, but not only in New England, the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians who settled a good deal of the back country, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and so forth, were taught the same sort of thing. And people throughout America with Huguenot background, Washington and John Jay were of Huguenot background, had basically the same kind of teaching taught to them. So he didn't invent that. He just picked up what was there in the culture, what had been there for a long, long time. You can go back to easily to the 1570s and so forth, and see this in the French Huguenot writings and so forth, and see it in the 1630s and 40s, and even greater magnitude in England, shall we say. So yes, they did believe that rebellion of the tyrants was obedience to God, but they did believe also that you basically should be led by the lesser magistrates. This is why, for example, the Declaration of Independence was signed by these various representatives as duly elected representatives of their state, as in opposition, let's say, to the French Declaration of Rights, which supposedly was framed on the basis of our Declaration, and to a certain extent was, but not very much. They're fundamentally, radically different. The French, the men who signed that French Declaration of Rights really were self-appointed leaders. They weren't duly chosen by the people. Anything like that. Okay, so there was a long heritage of Christian resistance thought that informed this. The soldiers and their leaders, we look at the people who fought the war. Most of them were Christian men. We look at the leaders of them. Not only was Washington a Christian, but you can look at such interesting little statistics as that at the Battle of Yorktown, all but one of the colonels in Washington's army, which surrounded Cornwallis there, were Presbyterian elders. The English thought that the war was basically a Presbyterian affair. They had confused the Presbyterians with the Congregationalists up here in New England, because they had a similar theology, although their views of church government were different. They called it the Presbyterian Rebellion. Sir William Walpole, who was the Prime Minister, I believe, of Britain, said, "Cousin America has run off with a Presbyterian parson." They very definitely saw the Christian nature of the rebellion against them, which wasn't really a rebellion, it was a rebellion to uphold the law against the tyrants. And that's the clear burden of the Declaration of Independence. It is a plea at law against the king in Parliament. It is saying the king and Parliament have violated the laws. And if you look at the Declaration, if we had time to do that, we could see that in the beginning you have a little legal philosophy set out there. There are God-given rights that you have. God is the author of these rights. Because he gives you those rights, they can't be taken away from you. Therefore, every man who is a rational man, who is a candid man, who is willing to consider what others have to say and admit his mistakes and so forth, will see that our rights have been violated, that there are such rights, that our rights have been violated by the king in Parliament. And they'll see that in particular because most of the Declaration, the part of the Declaration that is usually neglected, is a long list of what amount to these common law rights, English common law rights that people had under the many provisions of the common law, which the king and Parliament had violated by the various laws and regulations they had passed. So they gave you a little philosophy that said, look, there are these God-given rights, and then they gave you a whole long list of those rights that had been violated by the king and Parliament. And they said, look, we're justified in what we're doing. We appeal, therefore, to God, the supreme judge of the universe, the ruler of the universe. We appeal to the protection of his divine providence for what we're doing. Very definitely Christian trust to the whole thing. All right, we should also notice the role of the clergy. You ought to read on this Alice Baldwin's book, The New England Clergy and the American Revolution. Although it wasn't only the New England clergy who were very active. You also had the Presbyterian and Baptist clergy up and down the length of the land. But the clergy were the leaders of the revolution, very often led their congregations into battle and so forth, became chaplains and so forth. They prepared their congregations, first of all, for the conflict because they taught them biblical principles of civil government. They taught them through election sermons, through artillery sermons, through regular teaching in the church, and talk about religion and politics. I'm telling you, they really were deeply involved. They knew the biblical principles, and they taught them to their congregation. They taught them the whole counsel of God. They didn't say, politics is a is a forbidden area. That's a non-spiritual area. We can't get into that area. No, sir, they knew that the Bible applies to all areas of life. So they showed them what the scriptures said. The committees of correspondence upon which the revolutionary effort was begun and coordinated and so forth grew out of committees of correspondence between the churches, or among the churches, I should say, that grew up before the War for Independence. Because one of the main causes of the War for Independence, not the only cause, but one of the main causes was the Episcopal controversy. Carl Breidenbaugh has written a book called Mitre and Scepter, which you ought to read sometime. Big, long, very, very important book on this. Carl Breidenbaugh, B-R-I-D-E-N-B-A-U-G-H. A Mitre and Scepter. It really is an excellent book, which discusses the Episcopal controversy. Whoops. Try not to step on your toes too hard here. Now, there were a number of Anglicans, particularly in England, some of them also in northern parts of the U.S., where the Congregational Church was so strong and so established, who wanted, especially during the, let's say, the 1660s and thereafter, to establish an Anglican bishop over all of the colonies. Obviously, there had been none before. Really, when you're dealing with the Episcopal controversy, as Breidenbaugh points out, you're dealing with a controversy that was the most debated issue of the whole colonial period. More space in print devoted to this, more books and tracts and what have you, newspaper articles written on this subject than absolutely anything else. And we're not told about it by our normal humanistic historian. Now, this controversy increased during the, as I said, the 1760s, early 1760s, when you had a group, especially in England, who wanted to impose a bishop over all of the colonies so that they could exercise ecclesiastical control and uniformity over all of these colonies. You had too many of these rambunctious Congregationalists and Presbyterians and now Baptists, and then if you move down into Pennsylvania, you had Quakers and Baptists and Presbyterians and so forth. And even in the southern colonies, which were Anglican, which virtually all of them had established Anglican churches, there, not England and the Church of England exercised control so much as the local vestries, laymen exercising control, local self-government there was operative, just as it was in New England. And therefore, when they tried to establish the Anglican church, or this Anglican bishop, over all of America, the resistance was virtually nationwide, or colony-wide, shall we say. All of the colonies had people who resisted this idea. Needless to say, the Congregationalists in New England didn't like it, nor did the Presbyterians in the backcountry throughout the length and breadth of the Union, nor the other various denominations. And even the Anglicans down in Virginia didn't like it. At least many, many of them did not. And, of course, things weren't helped out very much when the authorities in England appointed a great big fat bishop with the unlikely name, or not bishop, but priest or minister with the name of East Apthorpe, to come on up to New England and check things out and see what needed to be done to get things established. He was a great big heavyset man who really enjoyed indulging his appetite. And one of the issues related to this established church was the issue of taxation, compulsory taxation. And if they would have sent a real skinny guy to come over here, it wouldn't have been so bad. They sent this great big gluttonous guy over here to lay the groundwork for establishing the Church of England as the church in America, or at least for establishing this bishopric here. And needless to say, this provided a lot of fuel for the opponents of the episcopacy, And when people saw this man being lavishly fitted out with a big house, they said, boy, now, if we get this thing established, you're going to have all sorts of folks over here going to be supported at lavish living at our expense. So, this is one of the important things behind the First Amendment, by the way. You had an opposition to this imposition of ecclesiastical rule over all the colonies. They wanted religious diversity, or at least those churches that were established in New England wanted to maintain control in New England, because they believed that they were teaching what was according to Scripture. And those that were the church-state establishments that were established elsewhere, the people of the states wanted to retain, or rather the colonies wanted to retain. So this, too, was another one of the main causes of the war. Now, the churches were very heavily involved, except basically for the pacifistic churches. Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Baptists were very, very militantly involved. Obviously, you had a lot of Anglicans, particularly laymen, involved in the battles, too, in the South, as well as Presbyterians and Baptists from the back country and so forth. So the churches were very, very much involved. The Anglican clergy, of course, were virtually all, not absolutely all, but virtually all Tories, which hurt the Anglican church a good deal after the war. But the churches were heavily involved. They didn't let Walter Cronkite or Ted Kopp or anybody tell them they couldn't get involved in politics, and not only because those guys weren't around. Okay. All right, now you can also look at various acts of the state legislatures and governors. When things were going well on the battlefield, they proclaimed days of thanksgiving to the Lord. They still had this covenantal view that we as a nation are in a covenantal relationship with God, the God who blesses or curses according as we have faith in Him and keep His commandments. Just as Deuteronomy 28, which you've already considered, tells us at great, great length. So when things were going well, they would come out with prayers of with days of thanksgiving and so forth. Or when things went poorly, then by the same token, they went poorly not just by accident, but because the providential hand of God had worked in your history to bring that about. They saw, like Washington, the providential hand of God in everything. So that you had days like this day of humiliation, prayer, and fasting proclaimed by the Virginia House of Burgesses, May 24, 1774, after the passage of the Boston Port Bill, which closed the Boston Port and so forth. They set aside June 1, 1774, as a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, devoutly to implore the divine interposition for averting the heavy calamity which threatens destruction of our civil rights and the evils of civil war, to give us heart and one mind firmly to oppose, by all just and proper means, every injury to American rights, and that the minds of His Majesty and His Parliament may be inspired from the loyal people of America, all cause of danger from a continual pursuit of measures pregnant to their ruin. Ordered, therefore, that the members of this House do attend in their places at the hour of 10 in the forenoon on the said first day of June next, in order to proceed with the Speaker and Mace to the church in the city for the purpose aforesaid, and that the Reverend Mr. Price be appointed to read prayers and to preach a sermon suitable to the occasion. Now, guess who this was recommended by? Thomas Jefferson. And that's something they don't like to tell us about either. Now, admittedly, he and some of the folks working with him did have to rummage around to earlier precedents from back in the 1750s, 1755, so forth, when they had trouble with the Indians. But they did. They knew to do it, and they did it. And that tells us volumes about the nature of public opinion at that time. Washington, by the way, sent a message to his family and his constituents to comply with this in the utmost seriousness. George Mason charged his own household to keep the day strictly and to attend church clad in mourning. All right, well, let's move on a little bit and look at the acts of the Continental Congress during the war. Just a few of these. First of all, the Continental Congress, knowing that there was a shortage of Bibles, acted as a publisher, mixing religion and politics, printed an edition of about 20,000 Bibles to be distributed to the people of these United States, these states which were proclaiming their independence. They had no New York Times or no national TV networks to tell them they were violating the separation of church and state, no Supreme Court to fuss at them, no federal judges and so forth, no ACLU to sue them. And, of course, none of those illustrious agencies would have gotten very far if they had tried. They also acted as an advertising agency for a Presbyterian minister who had had an edition of about 20,000 Bibles printed up on his own. They publicized this to the people of the state so that they could buy this man's Bible. Why? Because they knew the importance of getting the Word of God in the hands of the people. No concern at all there for separating Christianity from civil government, but rather obviously a concern for civil government to enforce Christianity, to promote Christianity. Maybe promote is a better word than enforce. They didn't require you to buy a Bible, but they let you know that they were available, so money was spent for that purpose. Now, they issued all sorts of, many proclamations of days of thanksgiving when the battles went well, by God's providence. On the other hand, days of fasting, prayer, and humiliation when God's providence did not work to give us victory. Okay. Now, these things were done by the state governments as well as by the federal government. Let me just read one about a day of thanksgiving. I have another one here on a day of fasting, but you've already heard one of those. This was issued by the Continental Congress November 1st, 1777. This is only part of the proclamation. These things were really long and involved, but great Christian testimony. Forasmuch as it is the indispensable duty of all men to adore the superintending providence of Almighty God, to acknowledge with gratitude their obligations to Him for benefits received, and to implore such further blessings as they stand in need of, and it having pleased Him in His abundant mercy not only to continue to us the innumerable bounties of His common providence, but also to smile upon us in the prosecution of a just and necessary war for the defense and establishment of our inalienable rights and liberties, particularly in that He hath been pleased in so great a measure to prosper the means used for the support of our troops, and to crown our arms with the most signal success. It is, therefore, recommended to the legislative or executive powers of these United States to set apart Thursday, the 18th of December, for solemn thanksgiving and praise, that with one heart and one voice the good people may express their grateful feelings, the grateful feelings of their hearts, and consecrate themselves to the service of their divine benefactor, that together with their sincere acknowledgments of kind offerings, they may join the penitent confession of their manifold sins, whereby they had forfeited every favor, and their humble and earnest supplication, in that it may please God, through the merits of Jesus Christ, mercifully to forgive and blot out the remembrance, that it may please Him graciously to afford us His blessing on the government of these states respectively, and prosper the public councils of the whole, to inspire our commanders, both land and sea, and all under them, with that wisdom and fortitude which may render them fit instruments under the providence of Almighty God, to secure for these United States the greatest of all blessings, independence and peace, that it may please Him to prosper the trade and manufactures of the people, and the labor of the husbandman, that our land may yield its increase, to take schools and seminaries of education, so necessary for cultivating the principles of true liberty, virtue, and piety under His nurturing hand, and to prosper the means of religion for the promotion and enlargement of that kingdom which consisteth in righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost. Lord, you don't hear enough proclamations like that these days, do you? Well, these sorts of things were done over and over again. Again, manifestly Christian documents. Really is a lot of fun to read these things. Very, very instructive to read these things. But we've talked about the Declaration of Independence a little bit being a Christian document. It wouldn't hurt you to know that every one of the men who signed that declaration was a church member. Not to say that they were all Christian. Jefferson certainly was not a Christian. He framed the document. But most of them were Episcopalians, by the way. 34 Episcopalians, 13 Congregationalists, 6 Presbyterians, 1 Baptist, 1 Quaker, and 1 Roman Catholic. So, all of the men who signed this were at least professing Christians. Not all of them were Christians, but nevertheless, this does speak volumes about the connections between Christianity and civil government. During this supposed period when Christianity was really out and deism was in. And by the way, it wouldn't hurt you to remember, too, that the God of deism was that watchmaker God who supposedly has created the universe, wound it up like a giant machine, and let it go. And who does not intervene in the workings of the universe that he's created. The God of deism is not a God of divine providence. He isn't the one who determines whether or not a sparrow is going to fall, or a hair falls from your head, and so forth.
Yeah. Then how can Jefferson be called a deist?
I would say by reason of historical inaccuracy, when it's not prevarication. Jefferson in his, what they do is look to Jefferson's private life, and they know that he denied the Holy Spirit and denied the divinity of Christ in his private life, not in his public life. And he essentially was really closer to a Unitarian than he was a deist. They also look to his stress on reason as a means by which men know things, and the deist certainly stressed reason. But as I pointed out, you can't judge a deist by the fact that he talks about reason, because the Christian folks talked about reason too. They meant something different by it than a deist does. They didn't mean that man's reason is autonomous, that it's self-sufficient. So they looked to Jefferson's stress on reason. They overlooked the fact that phrases like the laws of nature and of nature's God, of natural rights and that sort of thing were used by Christians with a Christian intent, with no intention or no notion that that natural law is inconsistent with the Bible, or that people's natural rights are inconsistent with the teachings of the Bible, and so forth. They overlooked this. They overlooked the Christian component and basis and foundation of this, and say, well, you can look at the writings of Thomas Hobbes from the 1640s and 50s and so forth, and then you look at the writings of John Locke from the 1680s, and those guys were definitely not Christians, although they do like to lie to us about Locke. Either that or they're ignorant about Locke. Let's be nice and say that they're ignorant about Locke. And they tell us that he was essentially a modern secularist philosopher who was answering Hobbes in kind, and therefore was assuming that man's mind is self-sufficient and that you have these rights as given, when in fact Locke was a Christian thinker. I think he was off base on a number of things, but he's a Christian thinker nevertheless. And they say that when somebody uses the word reason or natural rights, he's using Lockean terms, and Locke was, they like to say, a deist because he was influenced by Shaftesbury, an English philosopher who was a deist, and so forth. So they are simply not telling us, either telling us the truth because they know the truth and won't tell us, or because they don't know the truth about deism. Okay, but it's very clear that God's divine providence is completely inconsistent with deism. Okay. So when you see the framers of the Declaration of Independence appealing to God's divine providence for the rectitude of their intentions, as they tell you in the last paragraph, they weren't a bunch of deists. And when you look at the way God was spoken of in the Declaration of Independence, you have a pretty good little parallel with Acts 17. God is very clearly set forth as a creator. He is the one who gives you the rights. He is very clearly set forth as the ruler of the universe, the supreme ruler of the universe. He is very clearly set forth as the supreme judge of the universe. He is set forth as the providential controller of history. Those are not really very deistic sentiments, you know. And they are very, very definitely Christian sentiments. Now, you don't have a reference to the Trinity there. They should have put one in, perhaps, but the thrust is clearly Christian. Yes,
sir. What is your assessment of this dichotomy in his life?
I think that, like many people, he was... I don't claim to be an expert on... No, you mean Locke's life or Jefferson's life? That he was influenced by the Christians around him, but at the same time, in his own private speculations, he was influenced by rationalistic thinkers. I really haven't studied enough of Jefferson to know much about that, but I think the main thing is that... that in his public life, he didn't deny the divinity of Christ or divine providence. In fact, he believed in and affirmed divine providence in very strong terms in his public life. Yes. But people are inconsistent very, very often. You know. Well, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. If you deny God, I would argue biblically, you can't know that you can know anything. Follow Cornelius Van Til thinking on that. If you deny the God of Scripture, the sovereign Lord of Scripture, then you have just undercut your whole intellectual position. You don't have any means by which, in your own terms, you can know that you can know anything. But that's another topic we ought not to get off onto right now. All right, well, so the Declaration of Independence was then a Christian document. The fact that Jefferson authored the thing, you know, does not make it a deistic document, even assuming that Jefferson was a deist, which I don't assume. Because Jefferson was only one of a committee of three who were assigned to draft it. He did the drafting, to be sure, but he tells us that he only set forth the plain common sense of the matter. And if you look at the other documents formulated at the time, or before the Declaration of Independence, they were definitely Christian documents and definitely said basically the same thing as the Declaration. In addition, we have to remember that the Declaration wasn't just something that Jefferson, by fiat, sent down to us from the mountain, but rather that the Declaration was something that had to be approved by the other 55 men who signed it, anyway, all of whom were church members, professing Christians, and who included men like John Witherspoon, this great Calvinistic educator, who was one of the great... probably the greatest early president of Princeton, probably the greatest president of Princeton, period, who rejected the philosophy of John Locke, which we're usually told is written into the Declaration of Independence. So how do you come up with a deistic document signed by men who were virtually all of them, not all of them, but virtually all of them, Christians, church members and so forth, and how do you come up with a Lockean document signed by people who were militantly opposed to the philosophy of Locke? It was, in other words, basically a Christian document. It might not have all the theological statements we'd like to see there, but it was basically Christian. All right. Now, I'm not sure how much time we have left. Okay. So I'll try to just basically say that the Constitution itself, when we get to the Constitution, was definitely a Christian document. I'll argue that more fully as we go on, which contained many, many Christian principles. It was framed by men, virtually all of whom were themselves Christians. Not all of them, but virtually all. I'll go into that in more detail. It was ratified, moreover, by state ratification conventions, which, from the research that's been done, at least on the leading men in these conventions, we know, were conventions dominated, at least by leaders who were, virtually all of them, Christians. Not all of them, again, but if you go through and look at the lives of these men and find a man who was not a Christian, then you've got a discovery. Rather than being a bunch of deists and rationalists and so forth, the non-Christian is the exception. He is the discovery. And these men, by the way, who ratified the state constitutions, were not common, ordinary, insignificant people, you might say. They were men of substance in their own right, great figures in their own states, men of influence across state lines, a number of them, as well as within their states. They were great figures in their own right. All right. Now, beyond this, we can look to various other things about the historical context of Christianity. I don't have time to go into these things like I would like to, but nevertheless, we need to know that the connections between Christianity and civil government continued long after the Constitution was framed and ratified. And this is another evidence that tells me that the Constitution was a Christian document. Not the only thing by a long shot, but it is a very powerful argument against the Constitution being a secularist document. You have, for example, the first Congress. The very first Congress voted unanimously to attend church services both before and after Washington was inaugurated. Washington was inaugurated on a Thursday, not on a Sunday. And that tells us a little something. Look at presidential inaugural addresses. We don't have any secular humanist presidential inaugural addresses. We don't have any atheistic presidential inaugural addresses. We don't even have any agnostic presidential inaugural addresses. None of these men has told us, well, I'm not sure whether there's a God up there or not. Every one of them has affirmed belief in God and or his divine providence and in the dependence of the nation on God and his providence. Every one of them, whether they were Christians or not, whether they were Christians or Unitarians or unbelievers of some kind, each and every one has, if you read the addresses carefully, affirmed these beliefs, definitely Christian beliefs. You've had non-Christian presidents like John Adams, who evidently became a theological liberal in his later years, who very, very, very firmly and staunchly and openly praised Christianity. Jefferson praised Christianity. I could read you quotations about that. Washington certainly did this in his first inaugural address, in his farewell address. He did the same thing, warned us that we must not divorce Christianity from civil government, so forth. In addition, you have these presidential proclamations at the urging of Congress of national days of thanksgiving, or, on the other hand, of national days of fasting and prayer and humiliation and so forth. Madison, who we're usually told was opposed to these sorts of things on the grounds of separation of church and state, read separation of Christianity from the state, proclaimed at least four national days of thanksgiving. Didn't say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, I'm violating separation of church and state, but went on and proclaimed four of these. Jefferson did not proclaim any, but we'll see other actions that he did that were consistent with Christianity. There, Jefferson was consistent with his separationist views. But this continued to be done. State governors proclaimed such days, continued to do so. We still have U.S. Government chaplains in Congress, both houses of Congress. Madison, by the way, was the man who helped to establish the chaplaincy system in Congress. We'll return to this when we talk about the First Amendment. But there's another connection. Chaplains in the armed forces, chaplains in the federal hospitals and that sort of thing, state asylums and so forth. You could also spend some profitable time studying the Christian signs and symbols in the nation's capital on the various public buildings. The Washington Monument has all sorts of Bible verses on it and so forth. The dedication of public buildings was done even up into the 1850s, you can see, with ceremonies which were Christian and Masonic. Now, I think there's some syncretism there, but the Christian element is unmistakably there as well. So you had, well after the framing of the Constitution, well after the ratification of the Constitution, many, many ties of Christianity to our civil government. These things continued, as I say, up until after the Civil War, and many of them continue today.